Good day, everyone. My name is Jack Scholes, and I'm an alcoholic. I just like very much to be introduced as Jack P. There are many things in my background that I like to forget, and one of them is waking up and hearing my wife and the landlady saying, well, did Jack P again? You really don't need that after a while, you see. But I want to express my appreciation for you allowing me to fill in for Sybil's husband, Bob, who is indeed quite ill and has been for some time. It's been my pleasure to fill in for him in this last year several times with Sybil at functions like this. And it's always been an enjoyable pleasure for both of us to be here. This particularly already has been a very wonderful part of my life. I was wondering what to talk about when I came here because none of you knew who I am or have ever heard of me. I'm not a Clancy or a Johnny or a nothing like that there. I'm just a guy who came into Alcoholics Anonymous under false pretenses and managed to stay. I suppose I should start at the very beginning. I was told by my dad and my mother that I was born. And once I got here, I began a tour towards the second most important thing that any of us will have, and that is that journey towards the moment of my death. And it's between the moment of my life, my beginning, and the end of my life, that the moment of death, that this journey will take me and has taken me to various and sundry experiences, some of them good, some of them not so good, but in the last number of years, the best that I could ever expect to have. I came into this organization after having a background of drinking, as we all did, and none of the drinking that I did is going to impress any of you because you all drank. You know how to drink, and you know the results of drinking. We drank as long as we could, and then there came a time when we had to do something about it, and fortunately for us in these latter few years, the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous were there, and somebody, somehow, got a hold of us and brought us through the doors of AA to offer a life for the alcoholic that is to become a very interesting one, a very exciting one, a life that will give us the continuation of life that we had lost for so many years. I came into this organization on September 16th of 1946, and I was fortunate enough to have been met by a group of people there who were to take the time to tell me about this program of recovery. But coming in was rather a traumatic experience for me. I owned a beer joint up in Hollywood, and I've always considered that if you could get the stuff, you didn't have a problem. And since I had it, I didn't have a drinking problem whatsoever. But I wanted to get sober, and I couldn't. And I had a friend who, he and I had drank many years before. We had drank in San Francisco. We had lived on Skid Row together there. And he was selected because he was an excellent radio announcer in the early days of radio to do the announcing at the World's Fair at Treasure Island. And when they found him on the Skid Row, he and I went together up to a hotel, and I thought that was the most marvelous thing I'd ever done. Now I could sleep between sheets for a change and drink a little better wine. From the 49-cent thing, we went up, I think, to 85 cents, something like that, big high class. And for a period of time, we lived very well up on this hotel. Until the night came that he was introduced to Governor of California, and he walked across the stage to take a hold of the microphone, and he missed the microphone, and he fell right in the orchestra pit. And that put us right back on Howard Street, which is the Skid Row, and I hated the man. I hated him very much for taking me out of that. Fortunately, World War II came along, and he went in one direction, and I went into another, and we were to miss seeing each other for a few years. I'd gotten out of the service and gotten into Hollywood and had managed to get a beer joint after a while. I had first gotten a job with the railroad, and I was to find myself doing what every self-respecting alcoholic would do. They weren't paying me the kind of money that I thought I was entitled to, so I made my own salary, and I took their money to the extent of several thousands of dollars, but only because they weren't paying me enough, you understand. And they caught me, and I was on my way into prison. But I was fortunate. When I was talking to God about being born, I said, you be sure and put me in a family of some financial security. And he did, and so when I got caught for this poor longing of their money, I called my father, of course, and he came and he bailed me out. And so I didn't have to do any big jail time at that time. But it was in those days that I could blame my father on my drinking career. My mother was a German lady who lived in Peru, Illinois, and in Peru she was known as the greatest homebrew maker in the whole town. And every Saturday night the family would gather at her grandma's house and they'd have the regular Saturday night beer bust. And my dad took me back to visit there, and I was introduced to beer for the very first time. In fact, I was forced to go in. They all were sitting around the table and they were eating Limburger cheese and drinking beer. And I didn't like the smell of Limburger cheese and I declined to go in. And my dad said, "You will join this family." And I did, and they passed the beer and I drank it, and I drank enough to pass out, be put to bed, to be awakened in the morning by my uncle with a cold quart of beer, who said, "Take this, it'll take care of what ails you." And I did, and it did. And from that day till I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, there was always that morning after drink. I couldn't understand people who would suffer when there was a get-well way right away quick. When I got into the service, I met a young friend, and he was quite a friend of mine. We'd like to drink the same way. And we would go out and drink on a pass, perhaps on a Friday night or a Saturday, and we'd get just blind drunk. We'd wake up in the morning and get to the nearest bar, and as soon as it opened, we'd get in there and sit at the bar. But he was a peculiar type of a person. He didn't consider that he was a drunk of any kind if he didn't drink before noon. So we sat at the bar, all both so sick, and I start drinking, and I begin to get well, and I get weller and weller and weller, and he was sitting alongside of me getting sicker and sicker and sicker. At the stroke of noon, he'd get his first drink, and he'd begin to get well, and I'd begin to get sick. We never really got on the same plane in all the years we were together in the service. However, he also is a member of AA now, and we can talk on the same level at the time. But when I was released and got into Hollywood and got this beer joint, a little while later, Jack was released from the service, and he was given a job in the Armed Forces Radio Service, and they had a building right across the street from where my beer joint was. And we took up where we left off. We had some marvelous drunks in my place. We'd kick everybody out and sit there all night taking care of the world's problems, doing everything that a couple of good drunks will do, just having a marvelous time, the best friend I ever had. Then all of a sudden, almost overnight, this man became the biggest bastard I have ever known in my lifetime. He got sober, and there ain't nothing worse in this world than a good friend who gets sober and wants you to come to AA, because he gave me the worst time I've ever had in my life. In and out of the beer joints, 2, 3, 4, 5 times a day with some things to tell me, like, "Go out and look at the trees and the flowers. They're so pretty today." Terrible. There was an old bird in a tree behind my beer joint, and he kept saying, "You should go out and listen to that. That's a beautiful song it's singing." And so I got a shotgun from a neighbor to go out and take care of it. Fascinating. He did this for 5 months. And the very strange thing is that he never once mentioned why or what he was doing to stay sober. Not once. I'm one of those who came here not knowing anything at all about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never read about it. I never heard anybody talk about it. Complete neophyte. So when I came here, everything was going to be entirely strange to me. But in these 5 months that he kept coming in, he finally reached the bottom of the barrel. My beer joint was on one corner in Hollywood. Right across the street was the Hollywood Cemetery, and on the other side was Pierce Brothers Mortuary. And one day he came in, and in his loud voice he alerted everybody in the beer joint that he'd stopped at my friends at Pierce Brothers to tell them to get the gurney ready, that I was ready for my home across the street in the cemetery. And I 86'd him, and I never took any attention to that at all. But my wife decided that something had to be done, because I told her I wanted to get sober, and I couldn't. And so she asked a mutual friend what Jack was doing to stay sober. And Neil said he really didn't know. All he knew was that Jack had joined a cult called Alcoholics Anonymous. So, fortunately, we haven't had cults in here until the Pacific Group started in California. Now we got one. But she said, "Well, do you think that Jack will come and help my Jack?" And Neil said, "I don't know. I'll ask him." And so Jack came over this one morning. It was 10 o'clock in the morning. He loves to tell this story. It was 10 o'clock in the morning, and I was laying down on the cement floor of my kitchen in this beer joint, resting my eyes. I'd had my morning beer, and that was enough work. And he walked in with the AA book. In those days, the cover was red and yellow, so bright you could hear it 7 blocks away. You didn't have to read it. And he looked at me, laying down on the floor, and he said, "I hear you want to get sober." And I looked at him, and I pulled myself up on a little table and said, "No, I'm having too much fun." And so I ever knew in my life, whatever you're doing, that's fine, but when I get ready to get sober, I will. And the strange thing happened again. He never said one word. He just looked at me, smiled a bit, and said, "Well, if you ever need me, just call." And he left. There's a time, I believe, in every alcoholic's life when we reach a point, drunk as we are, when we become sober as we ever will be for a minute or two, and things seem to flash through our mind, and we find ourselves completely alone, that there is no place we can turn. If you have been a believer in God as we understand Him, and you've cried out to God so many times, "God, help me out of this," made the all of the things that you could with God, at this particular time, you can't turn to anybody. I felt as if I had dug a well, was in the bottom of the well. I couldn't get out. I couldn't see any light. I had no friends, no place to turn. The most desolate feeling I have ever had in my life, completely alone. Horrible feeling. Went back into the drunken stupor. The next morning, I called Jack. And he came over across the street, and I told him that I, whatever he was doing to get sober, I might try it. And he said, "Fine, you stay sober today, and we'll go to the meeting tonight." I'd been on a 3-year drunk at this time, drunk every day, passed out once a day for all that period of time. And he was telling me not to drink that day, and so I didn't for some reason. And he came to pick me up and take me to the meeting. And we started across town to where I was to attend the meeting, still not knowing anything at all about it. And the only thing I know is that I became panicky. Like every good alcoholic, when it gets right down to the final decision, we try to find a way out. In case it doesn't work, we want to have our ego in such a position that we can say, "Well, it didn't work because of." And I had been an agnostic since I was 11 years old. I was raised in a mortuary. My father was a mortician. And in all the funeral services that we had in our funeral home, a transcript was made of the service, whatever denomination it was. And it was printed up in a little booklet, and it was given to the surviving members. And it was my job at 11 years old to proofread that. And I early found that it didn't make any difference what denomination chose a scripture out of the Bible. No two ministers agreed upon what it said or what it meant. And I became an agnostic, and I was very plain about that even at that life, that I would not ever believe in anything like that. If these supposed learned men couldn't agree, then there must not be much to it. And the only thing that I could understand is that my dad said one time, he said, "Well, what do you think makes a seed?" He said, "Science can do everything. They can put the components of a seed, make it the same size, the same weight, with the same amount of differences in it. And you can plant it in the ground and nothing happens. But something that you pick off of another bush, put it in the ground and it grows into a beautiful flower. What do you think did that?" So I decided that whatever did that was this God that they talked about. It had absolutely nothing to do with me. Nothing whatsoever. And so with this idea in mind, I told Jack that if it had anything to do with religion, it would not work for me. And he said it had nothing to do with religion, and he kept driving. And the farther away from the area that I was familiar with, the more panicky I became, and finally I said again to him, "Now, Jack, I want you to understand that I'm an agnostic, and if this has anything whatsoever to do with religion, it will not work for me." And he said, "I've told you it has nothing to do with religion whatsoever," and he kept driving. By now I'm lost. I don't know where I am in Los Angeles, and it's dark. And so I screamed at him once again. And I said, "I want you to know." And I told him why I was an agnostic and the whole bit about it, my background of that. And he screamed right back and he said, "I've told you it has nothing to do with religion whatsoever." And he drove up in front of the Congregational Church and said, "Here we are." If any of you who are new are having trouble with your first meeting, just remember, it will go away, that first meeting of it. We went downstairs because he said the drunks went downstairs and the good people went upstairs. And I was to attend my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. In the condition that I was, not really sober, afraid to die and yet wanting to, sweating and just in horrible shape as we're all familiar with. And he set me down in the very front row, about 4 foot away from the speaker. Now I'm angry at this man because here I am in a church and this has nothing to do with religion and here I sit. And the first man who came up, I later became a good friend of, was our treasurer. And he was a very white-headed man, and he had a black suit. He always wore a coal black suit with a white shirt and a black bow tie. And he walked from the back of the room up when they called on him, And he put his hands like this, and right now I knew there's a preacher. You can tell it just exactly. And he said, "Good evening, friends." That's the way preachers start. And I was waiting for him to point the finger and say, "See, that's the result of demon rum. Drink and that's what you'll look like, you see." He didn't say that. And I'm telling the people around me, so they told me in a very loud voice, exactly what I thought of this place, of that preacher. And I haven't heard language in that for years until it's the new language in AA right today. The four-letter words have come out just fantastically. But nobody moved. They just kind of laughed and let it go. And he sat down, and then a man was to talk who was to show me right up front that there are many areas of recovery, that you learn much from other people. Not necessarily from what they say about the recovery program, but somewhat from some of their experiences, because we had a man there that we called the coach. And he was a member of the motion picture groups. And he was a D's, Do's, and Dem's guy. And he was talking along the way, and I wasn't listening very much. But he talked about being stabbed 7 times underneath the Venice Pier, of coming to in a hospital and hearing a group of doctors around him saying, "We've done all we can. This man should be dead." And he lived. And later on in his story, he talked about his brother who had studied for the priesthood. And at an early age, he was given a little parish in the Midwest. And he became very active in that community's youth and was doing an excellent job. And at 35 years of age, the man contracted tuberculosis and quickly died. And the thought came to me even then, what a strange thing. Here's a man who should have died. Every opportunity in the world, who was obviously no good to himself or to the community or to this thing called God that he'd been talking about, he was allowed to live. While on the other hand, his brother, who had studied for good and was certainly the best for his community and for himself and for his God as he understood him, he was taken away. Why was that? Why did that happen between those two different people? And I found out that that was one of the main things that has kept me coming throughout these years to Alcoholics Anonymous, to get an answer to the question, why? And I asked why many, many times throughout these past years. And so began a period of indoctrination. Went to this meeting, and they asked out in California, "Are there any newcomers here?" At that time, it was here for the first week. I'm sitting on my hands and shaking and sweating and unhappy. And a friend pulled my hand out from underneath me and held it up. And a black hand behind, in the row behind, pushed it down. And I didn't pay any attention to it. Didn't mean a thing. But we went to the meeting the next night, and the same situation. Jack had pushed my hand up, and this black hand would push it down. And after about 3 or 4 days, when I'm now sober enough to begin to notice that life was going on, this was very strange to me. One would push it up, and the other would push it down. And after the meeting, I noticed these two, a Negro gentleman and Jack, go over along the wall and get in a big argument. And I would walk over to try to stop the fight. And as I get close, they did the usual AA thing. They turned around with those great big smiles and say, "Everything's all right, Jack. Don't worry about a thing." Went on for 3 or 4 more days, and finally I really wanted to intervene in the fight. It looked like they were going to kill each other. And I walked over to them, and they did the same thing, and I said, "Okay, I don't know what you're doing, but I said, I want to get something straight here. I said, I don't care which one of you wins. Either put the damn thing up or leave it down, but let's forget this up and down thing." And this colored man said to me, "That's what we're arguing about, Jack." He said, "You don't know it, but I have taken it upon myself to teach you what I know about this program. And it is my hope that I teach you well enough and that you learn well enough that in turn you will teach. And who you teach will learn well enough that they in turn will teach. And we will keep this avenue open for the drunks who are going to follow us through all eternity." And that's the way I began. I knew nothing at all about sponsorship. I had no idea what he was doing. I was to find out that this man was in a different strata of society than I would ever have been in. We would never have been compatible in drinking. And yet we were to become the closest of friends in the next 8 years. That man and I talked on the phone once a day, every day, for all of those 8 years until he passed away. And he set a basis for the reason I'm standing here tonight. Because what he did was to tell me that he was going to give me all the expertise that he had. And if there's any question arose that he had been involved in his life, he would tell me what I did, what he did for it. And if it was a question that he had not been involved in, he would give me an opinion of what he thinks he might do. But he said, "I want you to understand full well that what I'm telling you is just that. It is an opinion. It's something that I don't know would happen." And he told a story that I like to repeat because it personifies that kind of an attitude. He said there was a man and his wife and a little boy out fishing in the middle of a lake one Sunday. Sudden storm came up and turned the boat over. The man was able to swim, and he's the only one who could, but he was only able to swim good enough to save his own self and one of the other two. One of them were going to have to drown. And he began to think, which one will I save? And his first thought was, I will save my wife. She's such a wonderful person, and we're so much in love. And we've produced together this son that's so wonderful. And so I will save her that we might have another son. And then he thought a minute, and he said, that isn't fair. He said, I can find another woman, I'm sure, probably not as good as this one, but perhaps equally so, and we can have another child. But I should save my son, because he came here. He didn't ask to be born. We brought him into this world. He has a right to live his life and be part of the community as he grows up and learn life on his own. And so I will save my son. And Jim stopped a moment, and he looked at me, and he said, and which one did he save? And I said, I don't know, Jim, which one did? And he said, you would never know unless you're in the boat. And how I have believed in that in all of these years, that when I am asked a question and I have not been there, it behooves me to explain that if I give you an answer, the answer that I'm going to give you is conjecture only. I do not know what would happen until I am in that area. If you can use what I'm telling you as an opinion, that's wonderful. But even if something that I've been through, you get involved in the same thing. And what I tell you, what I did, does not necessarily make the promise that you will get through it yourself. And he told me that I only had one problem in my lifetime, and it was the only one I would ever have. And that was that the problem is something that has an answer that's the same for everybody who's involved in it. One and one, the answer is two. Just that simple. That's the problem, one and one. And the answer to that problem is two. He said, you have a problem of drinking. And the answer to that problem is don't drink. Just that simple. And all the other things in your life you consider to be situations, and every situation for every person alive has a solution just for them. It may not be the same as your neighbors, even though the perimeters seem to be the same, but there will be a solution just for you, for the situation that you're in. And he went on, because he was the kind who always took the time to explain to me what he was talking about. He said, it's the same thing as divorce, as an example. There are many, many reasons for divorce. The thing happens, two people live together, they decide not to live together, and they get a divorce. One person's solution is to stay unmarried for the rest of their life. Another one is that they get remarried, each to somebody else, or get married to each other again. Whatever the situation is, the solution for them is correct, not necessarily because everybody who gets a divorce has to follow their plans. And so I have believed that has made my life much, much more interesting. We were talking this afternoon up in the hospitality room, and somebody mentioned about problems. And problems are the greatest thing in the world to throw us off of the track when you understand that it has to be the same as your neighbor. No deviation, no change. Your problem and their problem has got to have the same answer. But if you put the situation in there instead of a problem, you can be rest assured that this power greater than yourself has a solution just for you, and it will be given to you, and it will work out just the way it's supposed to be if you'll give it time and if you will believe in this power greater than yourself is in your behalf doing these things. And so Jim then began to do a little more. First thing that I asked this man who brought me, incidentally, he went to Australia and he died last January. But he took me to this first meeting, and after the first week, when he was taking me back and forth to the meetings, I finally said to him, Jack, what do I have to do now? And he said, well, of course, you have to go to meetings. And I said, well, that's interesting. How many meetings should I go to? And he said, well, as many as you can. And instead of shutting my big fat mouth, I asked him the last question. How many meetings do you think that is? And he said, every night, of course. So for 6 years, I went seven nights a week. I would get out of bed with the flu and come and infect a group like this all over Southern California. And you'd say, what are you doing here? And I'd say, don't tell me, tell him. He said, come to the meetings, and here I am. 6 years had passed, and he's getting ready to go to Australia. He was moving to Australia for a short while. His wife's family lived there, and they were going to visit and not going to stay. And so I went to him, and I said to him, you're leaving now, Jack, and I really want to know, can I take some time off from the meetings? And he said, well, sure you can. And I should have shut up again. Instead, I said, well, how many do you think? And he said, try one. So for the next 6 years, I went six nights a week. But I asked him another question. I said, Jack, you're leaving now, and I really would like to know if you have something that you can tell me that will almost guarantee my staying sober. And Jack said, well, in the first place, I'm not going to be gone very long. But while I'm in Australia, I'm going to think about that, because you're asking me a question about your life. And I want to be sure to tell you something that will in no way endanger your life whatsoever. And I'll think about it while I'm gone, and I'll have the answer when I come back. And I thought that's a good idea. You know, that makes good sense. He went to Australia. 24 years later, he came back. I met him at the plane. And after a minute or two, he pulled me aside and he said, "Do you remember that question you asked me?" And I said, "I sure do. And I've often wondered if you thought about it." He said, "Gave a lot of thought to it." And he said, "I want you to know that I have an answer that in no way will endanger your life. No way at all. And I'm waiting for a 15-minute dissertation of a philosophical nature that I could pass on to all you people." And so I said to him, "Well, what is that, Jack?" And he said, "Just don't take the first drink." Now, I knew that 24 years before. I had already heard that 10,000 times. But he was serious. And you know he was right? I never had any problem at all if I don't take the drink. And so Jim began this teaching process with me. And he prefaced it by saying that the purpose of this recovery program is to alter the attitudes that we brought here. And in order to do that, there are certain things that you're going to have to do on your own. Because as an alcoholic, you have built up, and I have built up, a way of attacking life in itself in order to preserve our own sanity and to blame it onto somebody else, whatever the case might be. "You must remember right up front," he said, "that your disease of alcoholism is predicated upon your inability of your body to throw off the alcohol in your system. And to combat that and to recover from that particular situation that's brought on by booze into your system of whatever nature, that the answer to that and the recovery is guaranteed if you just don't drink. That's all you need to know about the alcoholism that we talk about, the disease of alcoholism. But all you need to do to combat that disease of alcoholism is to not take the first drink." But I said, "That doesn't seem enough." And he said, "Well, you see, after you learn the first step, and it's the only one you can take out of context, the only one you can pull out of those 12 principles and look at it just as it is, that your powers over alcohol in your life have become unmanageable. When you begin to believe that to the depths of your soul, then you have a program constituting the second through the 11th step, followed by the 12th. And it is in these steps that you will find this attitude change that will allow those things that you thought whilst drinking to change and alter to wherein you as an alcoholic can live within this unnatural state of not drinking. Because you see, once an alcoholic, we were told, always an alcoholic. And we should live to drink and drink to live. And that's a natural state for an alcoholic. But when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, we are asked to change that life to where we are those who should drink and now are no longer doing it. We are now living an unnatural life, and that's a very serious and hard thing to contemplate and be a part of for a long time. And that's why I think the book says cunning, baffling, and powerful. And so in telling me these things, that I would have to use these second through the 11th principles to alter these attitudes. My attitudes are the same as every other alcoholic. When something happened that I was part of whilst drinking, I could always come up with an answer that it was your fault. If you hadn't done this to me, I would not have had to retaliate. I unfortunately killed two men before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in confrontations. One of them, I threw an old man off a train going across Texas. He had a bottle, and he took the bottle out, unfortunately, in his freight car. And I saw it, and I went over and asked him for a drink, and he wouldn't give it to me, and we fought, and I threw him off the train, and he was killed. And I did not realize until I'd been in AA for a while that I was asking for his life, and he was fighting desperately for his life because I'd been in that situation many, many times myself. And how do you live with taking another human being's life unless you have some way in your mind mentally to say it wasn't my fault? And what I thought for years was how selfish that man was. He got just exactly what he deserved. It would not have hurt him to give me a drink or two out of that bottle when I so desperately needed it. And I believed that. And in order to change that attitude, the thing that became necessary for me to do was try to find out a way that I could make amends to a man who I'd never seen before and I would never see again. A man who I don't know was a father or a grandfather or a husband, who was out there just another person, and I had taken his life. And how do you make amends to that? And in talking to Jim, he said, first you have to reconcile within yourself the fact that without drink you would not have done that. But you did it while drunk. And now the only way that you can make amends to that man is to stay sober and to learn the principles of this program, to pass them on as well as you can, wherever possible. And in so doing, whoever that man is, I'm sure he will be aware of it and he will accept your apologies as you have meant them to be. And I had to believe that, and that was the beginning of a change of attitude. Jim was very specific about the way I was going to do AA. I came in, as I told you, after 3 years drunk, And I wasn't allowed to get the book. I don't know what you do down here, but in California, you bring a newcomer in off the street, and your halo's on real straight because you've got a baby now. And you get him down, and if you listen for just a little bit to a meeting, and the time is over, you say, now get the book and go home and work the steps. And you walk away and say, I had a newcomer here, and I got him the book, and he's home working the steps. And you never see the guy again, you see. Jim knew that. So he said, I'll tell you when to get the book. 8 weeks went by, and I didn't get the book. Now, people of AA would say to me, you got the book? And I'd say, no. And they'd say, if you don't have the book, you ain't going to make the program. I go to Jim and say, I don't have the book. And the people say, without it, I'm not going to make this program. He had a stock answer. It was listen to them or listen to me, but you can't listen to both of us. Now, why I listened to him, I'll never know. But I always listened to him. One night, we were going to a meeting after 8 weeks. And on the way home from the meeting, he said, bring the money tomorrow night. We're going to buy a book. And I said, probably, Jim, I won't have the money. Things are not real good with my beer joint at this time. I may not have the money. He said, I'm not interested in that. All I'm interested in is that you get the money, and we're going to buy the book tomorrow night. And I said, but Jim, I may not have the money. And he said, well, steal it then, because we're going to make the book. I said, I thought this was an honest program. And he said, we'll take care of that later. Just get the money. Buy a book. So we bought the book. On the way home from buying the book, I said to him, how come we waited so long, Jim? Everybody else gets the book early. He said, all I'm doing is passing on what I had learned in this program. I came in here about the same condition you were. And he said, I know full well that my mind was filled with so many things. Couldn't pay the rent. The wife was leaving. The kids wouldn't talk to me. The boss was about to fire me. I was sick physically and mentally. There was no way that I could have read anything in that book and retained it. And you look to me to be in the same shape. But he says, in these last 8 weeks, your life has changed. These things are not so prevalent in your mind now. You're not afraid that the wife is going to leave. You can look at it in the cruel light of day and understand that time has taken away that fear that you brought with you. And now you can read the book and maybe retain it. And you'll read it more than once. If you'd ask you to do it the first time, you might have read a chapter or two. And because your eyes wouldn't focus, you might put the book down never to read it again. But now you'll read this book as a textbook in your life. But he said, to begin with now, you only read the first four chapters. And so I read the first four chapters over and over and over and over. And finally he said to me, you read that a long time. And he said, now it's time for you to find the most important thing in this book. It's your life that's dependent upon you finding it and understanding it. So you can read the rest of the book until you find that most important thing. And so I began to read. And I'd read several pages or a chapter. I'd find something that just made the greatest sense to me. And I would call Jim up and said, I found it. And I would quote it or out of the book what it was said. And he would listen, and he said, that isn't it. You better find it, because it's your life. And I'd read some more, and I'd get the same answer. And finally, he got as disgusted as I would, because when I'd tell him something, he said, you are the most stupid man I've ever seen. If that isn't it, find it. And so we got to going some more. Finally, he said to me, it's in the preamble. Now, even as stupid as you are, you can find that. So I read the preamble. Couldn't find it at all. I'd pick him up, and I'd say something, no, that isn't it, stupid. Find it, find it. Finally, he said, well, you're so dumb, I'm going to have to tell you. It's in the second paragraph of the preamble. Now, by God, you can find it there. And I read that second paragraph forwards and backwards. I was with that book. I'd pull off the freeway. I'd read the second paragraph. I'd go to the bathroom. I'd read the second paragraph. I never went into a restaurant to have a sandwich without reading the second paragraph. I finally went to him, and I was starting word for word in the second paragraph. And he said, oh, no, no, we're not going through that. You find it. I'll help you one last time. He says it's in the second sentence of the second paragraph. Now, by God, you can find it there. Finally, he had to tell me, to make a long story short, and this was now 8 months that I'd been in AA. And he said, what does that second sentence, what does it say? And it says, if you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. I didn't find my life in there, and I don't think many other people found their life in there. And so I told him, I don't see what's important about there. He said, you read it, but you didn't read it the way it's printed. It says, if you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, hyphen, a little black line in the middle of a sentence that's just there, just there. But that hyphen means that you pause to consider what has preceded this black line. Have you decided you want what we have? And he said, do you think you have? And I said, why, sure. And he said, well, what do we have that you want? And I said, peace of mind, serenity, a job, a wife off your back, all these nice things that we hear about. And he said, that isn't what we got. He said, what I'm talking about is what all of us have who are sober. He said, all of us, man or woman, and we're all different. Some are married and some are not. Some are children, some haven't. Some have good jobs, some don't have. But it's among that group that you have to find what they have that you really want. And I said, Jim, how do I do that? He says, it's very simple. You just go back to your home group and you ask the people in there what they have. And like a dummy, I did just that. I went back in the first night. I went up to a very good friend of mine in these 8 months, and I said to Andy, I said, Andy, it's very important that I find out something from you. And he said, what's that? I said, I have to find out what you have that I want. He never hesitated. He never hesitated. He said, my wife, and take her home tonight. I asked a few more people in there until I got smart. I finally got down to one of the women in our group. She very seriously said, Jack, I hope you won't take what I have. But she says, I have terminal cancer, and you can have that if you want it. And I went back to Jim, and I said, Jim, that was the stupidest thing you've ever had me do. And he said, no, it wasn't. I said, why wasn't it? He said, didn't you notice anything amongst the people that you talked to? And I began to think. And for some reason, I was able to understand what he was meaning. All of those people were sober. All of those people were sober. Not filled with sobriety, as I came to understand sobriety. Not peace of mind, happiness, serenity, love of God, and love of children and people. But they were all sober. In any degree, they were all sober, without alcohol in their system. And Jim said, do you want that? And like every other good alcoholic, I said, of course I do. He said, do you really? This is where you go back to your past life, and you use it as a frame of reference. How often did you say I'd give anything in the world to be sober? And I said, every time I stand up in front of a judge, of course, if I could just be sober. And he said, what happened? And I said, I do the time or get kicked out or whatever it was. And he said, did you want to be sober? I said, long enough to get to the bar, that's all. So he said, soberness is not the thing that you really wanted, was it? Thinking, and I said, no, that isn't. Well, he said, that's the bottom line. If you'll read this last paragraph in chapter 2, it tells us that all of our adventures are the cement that binds us together. But that's not enough. That we have to seek and find a common solution upon which we can all agree and live in harmonious action. That's the whole purpose of this recovery program, to find that common solution. And what is the common solution? The common solution is that you want to be sober, just sober. And all of these other things come because you're sober, because you're sober. And he said, then it says, to what lengths will you go to get that? And he said, it doesn't mean getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning on a rainy night and going out to have some drunk puke all over you. What it means is that there comes a time, and it comes to every alcoholic life that I've ever talked to, when everything seems to going the wrong way, when it's easier at the moment to make the decision to take the drink than not to take the drink, when everything cries out, your body, your mental attitude, to get the peace that comes from taking the drink that the alcoholic knows so well. And when you grit your teeth and you say, no, I won't take it, and maybe you do this every 10 seconds for a while, but the pain is so great and it builds up, and yet you say, I won't drink. And this happened to me. I was in a situation where that happened, physically and mentally. Worst I've ever been in my life. And I went home to my apartment, and I locked myself in there, and I stayed for 2 weeks. And at the end of 2 weeks, I went back to my bar early in the morning, and sitting at the end of the bar was my friend Jim. And I said, what are you doing here so early? He said, I've been here every day for 2 weeks. I've called you on the phone a number of times, and you haven't answered, and I've been by your house. And I've knocked on the door and got no answer, though I knew you were in there. And he said, I want to know something. And I said, what is that? He said, did you drink? And I said, no, I didn't. And he said, did you want to drink? And I said, you'll never know how much I wanted to drink, how hard it was. I sat and cried in the pain that what I was going through, how badly I wanted to drink. But he said, you really didn't drink? And I said, no, I didn't. I didn't drink. He says, then according to your life, in that second sentence, in that second paragraph, as pointed out by that little black line called a hyphen, it says, then you're ready for certain steps. Not before, not just because you walk in the door, but until you have come to a conclusion within yourself deep down that no matter what, you will not drink. Then these steps will mean nothing to you. You must open up your heart and your emotions to understand truly whether or not this is what you want. And if you can withstand anything and everything, if your desire so to do is so strong. And he said, you'll have to find a dependence upon God that will help you do that. And I said, fine, except I don't believe in God. I was an agnostic, and he knew it, and I was an agnostic for 6 years in AA. And I stood up with you when you said the Lord's Prayer and looked around to see all the hypocrites in there, holding hands, mouthing the words, wouldn't say them. So I said to Jim, you know, I'm an agnostic, and people say if I don't believe in a power greater than myself, I won't make the program. And he said, that's all right, Jack. He said, just look at the second step. He said, what does it say? And it says, came to believe the power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I quoted it to him, and he said, sure, that's the way it's printed, but what does it say? And after a little bit of discussion, it came out that it says, came to believe. And he said, does it give you any time on that? Does it say you have to believe Tuesday next week at 10 o'clock? Or 6 months from now? He said, I'll make a personal guarantee to you that if you will continue to attend these meetings on a regular basis and keep an open as mind as you possibly can, that in time you will come to believe. And since he had not told me anything that I couldn't believe up to that point, I accepted that. And one day, somewhere along the way, I would come to believe. And I was standing up at a meeting after 6 years in AA, and a friend standing next to me punched me, and he said, you know what you're doing? I said, what am I doing? He says, you're saying the Lord's Prayer. And to this moment, I don't know why. I do not know why. But that was to be the beginning of a life in this program that changed from the normal aspect of the drunk who comes in here and thinks he can handle everything to learning about and accepting the premise that the power greater than ourselves will in all cases help us if we will let that power in. And so began another thing, finding to learn about this thing. And I had a hard time. I said the Lord's Prayer, but I didn't really believe in it. And then I'm a great one to learn things from sometimes silly stories. And I heard a story one time, it opened up the doors to a God as I came to understand him. There was a foursome who went out to play golf. Amongst it was a minister and one of his parishioners. And as they went through their game of golf, everything was going fine until they got to the 16th hole. And the parishioner had a 3-foot putt in order to win the hole. And he missed it. And he started cussing. And he really started cussing. And the minister looked at him and he said, please, you don't have to do that. We don't need that cussing here. That was just a mistake. And so the parishioner said, I'm very sorry. It won't happen again. He got to the 17th hole. He missed a 2-foot putt. And he really cussed. He just went at it and at it. And the minister finally stopped him and he said, look, I ask you not to do that. And if you're going to continue to do this, I'm going to call upon God to smite you with a bolt of lightning. And the man said, I didn't really mean it. He said, I got so intense in this game, I didn't mean it at all. But I won't do it again. You get to the 18th hole, he has a 6-inch putt. And he missed it. Boy, he really took off with the profane language at that time. The minister looked at him and he said, I told you what I'm going to do. And he looked up to the heavens and he said, God, smite this sinner with a bolt of lightning. And a little black cloud started across the sky. It got right over the 18th hole. Out of the middle of that little cloud came a bolt of lightning and it hit the minister right on the head and knocked him right to the ground. And a beautiful voice out of that cloud said, damn it, missed again. That kind of a God I can understand, you see. I really can understand that. That gave me an insight. And from that day to this, my life has been concerned with the change of attitudes that I brought with me into the attitudes that have allowed me to live quite comfortably. I have had much help along the way, as all of us have. I'm very fortunate. I have a baby in my house, my wife. She's only got 28 years on the program, and so I get an opportunity to tell her how this thing works from time to time. Point out her mistakes as she goes along and this sort of thing, and that has been a help too, you see. But then I heard some other things. Amongst these things that I heard was that there are two plateaus of spiritual bodies. That the first plateau is belief. And this is the area when we say to each other and to ourselves when we're asked, do you believe in a power greater than yourself? And we say, yes. Yes, we believe. And we go along under the assumption that we believe, and then a tragedy hits, the loss of a child or a wife, or illness hits us, or a financial thing comes about that we feel we don't deserve. And somebody says to us, do you now believe? And we say grudgingly, yeah, I believe, but if there really is this thing called God, why is he picking on me? I haven't done anything to deserve this. I really am not sure, but I suppose I believe. And that's belief. And it takes a long time on this program to understand belief is a vacillating thing. And one day it's there in all its glory, and the next day you have a hard time finding it, but you can mouth the words, yes, I believe. Then there comes another plateau along the way when you've done the footwork, and you've indulged yourself in the prayers that are necessary for your recovery and the recovery of the alcoholic next to you. When you arrive at the plateau, and the top plateau, spiritual growth and spiritual values, and that's the plateau of faith. Now, faith is different than belief. Faith is that area where God is, and there's no question, where God is. This is a place where no matter what happens to you, no matter what the circumstances, how bad it turns out to be, that without question you say and honestly mean it, God is.
And people say that's impossible. We're all human and we have these human failings. But it is possible, and you'll find it in AA. You will find it so often in AA. I'd like to deviate a bit from my own story now and tell you what I have learned about this recovery program in my own life and what it has meant to me. I was fortunate enough in 1946, along with a woman, to start the Institutional Committee of Southern California, the first such institutional committee that was in existence back there. And Dwayne and I did the footwork for the first 2 years, going into these institutions and asking if we might put our program in there, because we felt it might be of some help to the inmates and the patients of the hospital and of the prisons. And we were met with all kinds of dissension. We were kicked out of some. We were told never would we be allowed in. We finally were able to make an appointment with ex-sheriff Gene Biscuit, the old man of Los Angeles County. Marvelous old gentleman. We made an appointment with him. We went in to see him, and we took the book, and we told him what we would like to do. And we left him the book and asked him if he would read it. And he promised to read it. He said, "You will hear from us in just a few days." We got a call from his office saying that he'd set up an appointment with us as his care and treatment officer. And we were to go down there, and he'd send a letter down to Captain Stallings, who was to put our program into the institution. And all that the captain asked us was, "What are you going to bring us? What are you going to bring us?" And we had wondered what we were going to say, and we'd never discussed between Wynn and I really what the premise was. But because this power knew we were in the right place, I guess, the words came. "We are going to bring you two things. We are going to bring you a program of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. If we say there will be at 7 o'clock on a Tuesday night, we will be there at 7 o'clock on a Tuesday night, unless there's some disaster. And then we will let you know ahead of time so you can fill that time slot in your prison program. And the second thing we're going to bring you are people who will adhere strictly to the rules and regulations of your institution. We'll take nothing in and bring nothing out." And that was all we told this man. And we were put into their system. And from there, we were allowed to go into the state hospital, into the state prisons, into the federal prisons, and in the second year, Wynn and I were able to establish 80 such meetings in these institutions. And it was while we were getting involved in the camp that they have out there, from jail, they send you out to these work camps. We went out one night, after I had been in about 2 or 3 years, we went out to this meeting. And after the meeting, an old man came up to podium where we all were standing. He was an Indian man. He was the ugliest, meanest looking man I have ever seen in my entire life. He had been out in the tomato fields. The sun had burnt him almost black. His scars on his head were white and they glared out at you. His eyes were close together and his mouth was tight. And he came up and he looked at me and he said, "You mean you haven't had a drink for a year?" And I said, "No, I haven't." And he walked away. And the next year I was at another camp, and here comes this mean old man. I'd forgotten him in that year. But I went up to this particular camp, and here he was. And he came up, and he said, "You mean you haven't had a drink this year either?" And I said, "No, I haven't." And he walked away. And the third year, in another one of the camps, county camps, he was there. And he asked me again, "You mean you haven't had a drink this year either?" And I said, "No, I haven't." And the fourth year, I went out to Chino, which is our state prison. By this time, I knew the man. We were getting to be quite friendly. And when he came up after the meeting, I said, "Chief, you got the same question?" He said, "Yep." I said, "I got the same answer. I haven't had a drink this year either." He said, "My time has been set here. When I get out, I'm going to try this thing you've talked about in 4 years, in four different places." And he said, "I'm going to see if it works. I don't know, but I'm going to try." And he got out, and he went up in the Riverside, San Bernardino area, and he became very active. He became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He set up chairs. He swept the floor. He washed the cups. He cleaned the ice trays. He went on 12-step calls. He became a working member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And after a couple of years, I received a letter from the man from the hospital in Fontana. And in this letter, he spoke about the reason that he had written me is he wanted to know if I thought he had lost his time on the program, because he'd been taken into the hospital. They found out that he had an inoperable cancer in his stomach. But while he was laying there so sick he couldn't move, they brought in a tray of medication. And one of the things on the tray was a shot of alcohol. And why it was there, I don't know. And he never said, and I never asked a doctor why, but it was there. And he drank it. And he said, as soon as that hit my stomach, I knew when the nurse would make her next rounds, I knew where my clothes were, and I felt I could get out of bed, put my clothes on, get downtown, get a bottle, and be back in bed before she came. First drink is a bad one. First drink, never to me. I made a bet one time that I could drink a case of beer in an hour. I preceded that by drinking 3 quarts of beer to get tuned up and drank the case in 52 minutes. So what do you mean? One drink's going to get you drunk. But that's what he said. And so I, of course, wrote him back and said, "No, no way that I have anything to do with your continuous sobriety. The next call I got was from a nurse at the Long Beach Naval Hospital several months later, and she wanted to have me come down because the chief wanted to talk to me. So I drove down to Long Beach. Now, I'm one of those who understands what death is. It's our destiny, each and every one of us, and I never have felt too bad about death. The loss of somebody physically is a wrench in my heart than it is in yours, but it isn't really that bad. We shouldn't really complain about it. You see, we alcoholics particularly are those who move about. We go from here to New Orleans, and we come back because we don't like it in New Orleans, and we go to Oklahoma, and we don't like it, and we come back, and we go all over, and we always are returning. But those who die, wherever they go, they like it so well, they never come back. So why should we argue? They stay there. And so, thinking about that on the way down to this hospital, a peace came over me that I was unable to understand, that I felt almost joyous of going down and seeing this friend of mine. And I got to the hospital, and I went up to his room, and the nurse was waiting there. And she said, "Hey, you can stay just a little while. But the chief is dying, and we don't know when, but it's soon." And I walked across the room, and there on the bed lay the chief, this mean, old, ugly man, now laying on there so thin, you could see almost see his teeth through his lips. But there was a light in his eyes and a smile on those lips that'll be with me until the day I die. So I said, "Hello, chief," and he said, "Hi, Jack." We talked about Alcoholics Anonymous and the people that we knew in AA for a little while, and his voice began to get less and less. And finally he said, "Let's talk about my dying." I said, "All right, chief, let's do." He said, "You know, in the years that I've been in AA, I've tried my best to make amends wherever possible." And he said, "The amends that I need to make more than anything else is to my dad and mother, and they've been gone so many years. But wherever they are, I truly believe that they have seen what I'm trying to do. But," he said, "now I'm going to get to tell them face to face, make those amends." Now he can hardly speak. And he finally said, "And more than that, Jack, I'm going to get to shake God's hand." And the nurse said, "You'll have to leave." And I went to the door in an absolute whisper. The chief, in the last words on this earth, said, "Jack." I said, "Yes." And he said, "When it's your turn, I'll be at the gate to meet you." And he died. Now, this may not mean much to you. This happened many years ago, and I still crack up on it. Because I can't think of anything greater that this program would ever bring me than to know without a doubt that one of us is waiting at the door to give me a personal invitation to this God as I understand it. What a marvelous thing to look forward to. And that was the carry through for many of the incidents that happened in my life through the giving of oneself, of changing the attitudes, of going in and doing things for those who can't come to us. I went to the General Hospital to put the meeting in there. We were given the opportunity to meet on the sixth floor. And we were to be there from 7 o'clock until 10. And on the sixth floor was a podium of which they had put a book. And in the book opened up to that floor where the patients on that floor was what they were in there for. And we were told that the nurses or the interns or the doctors would help us disseminate those that were there for alcoholic-related facility or illnesses or the others that weren't. But for 2 weeks we went up every night, stayed till 10 o'clock, never could get up to the book because in those days the nurses and the doctors didn't believe in us. We were not professionals. Finally, the committee had asked that I go back and tell the people at the hospital that perhaps we were there too early and that we would have to withdraw our being there until such time as they thought it was necessary for us to come back. And this night that I walked up, I took another friend with me. And the only one at the desk was a middle-aged woman dressed in a nurse's uniform. We walked up and she said, "Are you from AA?" And we said, "Yes, we are." And she said, "I want you to know that we understand your problem here. And we have staff have taken care of that, and never again will you have to worry about getting to this book." But she said, "What brought this about was that we noticed you came here every night, and you stood alongside the wall, and you talked amongst yourself, and you stayed from the time that you said you would until it was time to go. And you came back the next night, even though you didn't get to see the book." And this went on for this period of time, and she said, "I wondered about this thing." So she said, "You talk so much about your book, I went and bought it." And she says, "I have a drink maybe once a year, maybe at Christmas time." And she said, "I'm not a churchgoer. I can't remember the last time I was in church." So she, you can see I'm not a religious person. So I got the book and I read it. And a strange thing happened and I couldn't put my finger on it. There was just a feeling I couldn't understand. And so I read it again. And she said that feeling was stronger the second time than it was the first. And I thought maybe you might help me to understand that feeling. And we thought she wanted to talk about the book, but instead of that, she took us down the hall into a room, and there on a bed lay a man strapped down. His ankles and his wrists had been strapped to the side of the bed. He was in deep DTs. He was twisting and turning and moaning and groaning, and blood had come through his ankles and his wrists. And I looked at her, and I said, "He won't understand." She said, "I just would like to have you talk about your program in this room." And I said again, "But he won't hear." And she said, "Perhaps not, but please, will you do this?" And we thought it strange, but Ray and I got on each side of his bed, and we were assuring each other that this man wouldn't hear. And we started talking, as two AAs will do, about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And about 45 minutes later, when she came in, the only thing we noticed during this time was that this man on the bed didn't twist and turn so much. And he didn't cry out so much. He just laid a little bit quiet. And she came in, and she thanked us, and we left. And you can't leave an alcoholic in that condition without knowing what's going on. So I went back the next night, and sure enough, there she was. You know, she said, you're interested in what happened last night? I said, most assuredly. Well, she said, first let me tell you, if this man that you talked to in his room last night continues to improve in the next 3 days as he has this day, hopefully he will be out of here and perhaps join your group. She said, he didn't hear, you said, but something happened because he was 2 hours laying there without making a motion after you left. But she said, the reason that I wanted you to do this, that feeling that I got in reading that book that I couldn't put a finger on, had to be something of a spiritual nature. There had to be a power there that I could not understand and yet I could feel, and I'm not an alcoholic. The power of the power greater than ourselves permeates all of those who are involved in holding in their hand that book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's not much of a story on the end because we all know the power of that book. But I was asked to go to Garden Grove, and I went there to talk. And as I walked into the meeting, I was met by a young man who I'd never seen before, who asked me if I would give him his cake that night. And I said I'd be glad to, but I thought perhaps his wife or his sponsor should do that. And he said, "No, we've agreed you should do it." He said, "I knew you were coming, and we thought you should do it." When they called his name, we walked up to the front to take his cake. And they brought out a cake that was aflame with candles, the whole thing covered with candles. Before he blew out the candles, he looked at his group, and he said, "I want you to know why this man is giving me this cake." He said, "I knew he was coming, but I've never met him. But I had been told by a nurse about two men who came to see me in the hospital 32 years ago tonight, and I didn't hear them, and I haven't had a drink since." What a marvelous expression of what the spiritual values and the faith that comes knowing your unknowing that you and I get by being a part of this fellowship, of giving to all of ourselves to all who choose to ask, for being available at any given moment to share with you at any time that which you have found in this program. And sometimes it's hard. Sometimes we don't really know what it's all about. And along the way, we find that there are times when we think this is dull, and yet it isn't dull. I've had so many good experiences in this program that are absolutely fantastic to think about. After I'd been sober a short while, seven of us got an apartment down in Los Angeles. And we had little meetings every day. We sort of went out and solicited members from bar schools and so forth. We got a call one day from a woman who said that she had heard somewhere or other that we were a group of men who would help a drunk. And we said, "Well, we do our best. Why?" And she said, "Well, I have a husband. And if something doesn't happen, he's going to die. In any event, I'm going to have to leave him." And I thought maybe before that happened, you might be able to help him. And we said, "Sure, we'll come call on him." And she told us where she lived. She lived clear out in Santa Monica. And we were clear downtown in Los Angeles. And we all got in an old clunker that we purchased, all seven of us together. We jammed into there and went out to her home in Santa Monica. She told us to go through the gate and go back into the back. She'd leave it open and go back in the back through the den doors, and we'd see him. And so we did. We went back there, and we looked through the den doors, and sure enough, there he was, passed out cold on the floor. And we went in, and we gently picked him up, and we put him in the car, and we took him back to the apartment. And the next morning, he became typically alcoholic. "You got the wrong man. I'm not a drunk. I don't need you." He goes through the whole routine that every alcoholic goes through. And so we said, "Sure, we understand all this." And so we took turns staying with this man. We didn't let him out of our sight. Somebody was with him 24 hours a day for a whole week. He kept protesting, "I'm not the man," and he was going at this, and we kept saying, "Sure, sure, sure." Somebody turned their head, and he got away. And we put our halos on and said, "Well, we did the best we can, and when the time comes, he'll have the message anyway. He'll have heard about it. A seed has been planted, if you will, And so we promptly forgot it. About a week after that, telephone rings. Here's a woman on the phone. I thought you were going to do something for my husband. And we said, well, he ought to be home by this time. He left here a few days ago, and he should be home by this time. And she said, I want you to know that wasn't my husband you picked up. That was a painter who was painting the house. Her husband was in the bedroom. He could pass out in the bedroom. So we went and talked to him, and to my knowledge, he's still sober. Well, we've talked about that many times, and I know we were thinking about that shortly after it happened, and we were sitting there thinking. And the thought came to me, can't you just imagine this guy who was not an alcoholic, who we'd had for 7 days, and he goes home, knocks on the door, and his little wife comes to the door, been looking for him for a week. And he looks at her, and he says, honey, you ain't going to believe this. And I guarantee you, she's not going to believe it either. It was fantastic. Another very interesting thing that occurred in my life, one of many, many hundreds of things. I went to San Clemente to a meeting, and a woman came up to me, and she started crying and telling me about her husband. They had a factory going, a ceramic factory, and they were gradually losing it because of his drinking. And all the group members there said, pay no attention to her. She's hit everybody in this whole area. And he doesn't want any part of it, so don't waste your time with it. And I thought, well, you can't do that. You have to make a call anyhow. So I told her that I would come down, and I was selling New York Life Insurance at that time, and I said, I'll come down to talk to him about insurance, and then inadvertently, I'll give him some pamphlets, and maybe we can get him to talk about this. I got down there one morning about 10 o'clock. She went and got him from the office. He came out boiled. Oh, man, he was drunk. And I told him I was from New York Life, and he screamed and hollered, get the hell out of here. I don't need insurance. I don't know what part of it. Don't you ever come back in here. And he just goes in a big tirade, slams the door. And she looked at me with tears in her eyes, and I said, I tell you what we'll do. You write me every week what he's been doing. Now, in this little town, there's a drugstore that everybody meets in. And I said, you write me a letter telling me what he's done, and I'll take it from there. But you write one every week. And so she started. And she'd write me a letter and tell me the escapades that he'd gone through that particular night. And I wrote a letter back to him. And I would say, I was passing through, and it was at the drugstore the other day, and I saw yak, 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 whatever he did. And I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if I ever see him in a meeting, I'll introduce myself. And this went on for about 6 months. Every week he got a letter, and I was telling him exactly what he did. Always ended up by saying, if I ever see him in a meeting, I'll introduce myself. I went to Santa Ana. And I go in there, and I look around, and there he is. He don't know me, but I sure as hell know him. The moment of truth comes. Now, do I tell him who I am and get the hell beat out of me, or do I just forget it and go about my business? And I went up to him, finally, after the meeting, and I said, John, I've been writing you letters for about a little over six months now. And I said, I told you if I ever saw you in the meeting, I'd introduce myself, and I'm all prepared to have a real battle. And he doubled up his fists, and he started glowering at me, and then all of a sudden he started to smile, and then he broke into a laugh. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, for the last 6 months, I've been going to a meeting every night up and down this coast looking. And that man's still sober. That man's still sober. So it became part of my life to infiltrate my emotions and my feeling about life in itself. And after I had come to believe that there was a power greater than myself, and Jim had told me that these now are going to be living principles, not a single one to be taken separately, all of them together. But what you've come to believe, you cannot turn your will over to something that you don't believe. And so those two tie in together. And you can't make a fourth step in any honesty without having the help of the power behind you, the strength that it will give to you. And you can't take a fourth step unless you are aware of the fact that you're going to have to tell it to another human being. And you can't make a fourth step in reality unless you use the sixth and seventh to find out some of the transgressions you've gone through. And in doing all this, you're aware that when all this is done, that there's a period of time that you are going to have to make these amends wherever possible. And then the greatest one of the whole bunch is number 10. Continue to take inventory, and when you're wrong, promptly admit it. The most individualized step of the principle. This is yours and mine, each and individually. This is a personalized effect that we have upon ourselves. continue to take inventory. When we are wrong, promptly admit it first to us, first to us. Because the more we do these things and the more times we have to say, I'm sorry, you have to understand what you've done, the less times that happen in the future. Pretty soon these things will not be part of our life and we'll live in a very comfortable state of being. And if by chance I have hurt you during this period of the 10th step of action, I will then come to you after I have cleared my own mind and I will tell you that I am sorry for what I did and hopefully it will not happen again. And I have gone through the principles and I have come to the 10th step and I have alerted myself to the transgression that I hope never to be a part of again. And then I go to the 11th step where it becomes possible to seek out this power greater than ourselves that we can't understand and we can't draw a picture of. Nobody can tell us from whence it comes or where it goes. And yet the feeling is there and we all, not blindly, but within the greatest of faith, believe there is such a power someplace. And so we have done the change of the attitudes. And there are times when it takes outsiders to even help us in that particular line. Growing up next to me was a young boy. His wife, his mother and his father fought for fun. They never went to shows. They never went to dinner. They fought with each other. He would come home, and I'd hear him open the door, and he'd say, honey, I think we will. And she'd say, no, we won't. He didn't have any idea what he was going to say. And they would fight. And little Freddie kept from the time he was a little boy. He'd come over, and he'd say, well, when I get married, I'm not going to live like Dad and Mom. I'm not going to fight like that. And as he went through first his younger years, and he kept saying this, finally got in his teenagers, and I said, how are you not going to do this? You see, when you find somebody, how are you going to make sure that you're not going to fight like that? And he said, because I'm going to let her know who's boss. And I said, sure you will, you know. When he got to be 18 years old, he met a very lovely young lady, and they went together for 2 years and decided to get married. And they were going up to Las Vegas, so I called little Freddie over, and I said, Freddie, now you're making this big step. Have you told her who's boss, and if so, how? He said, I haven't yet, but I will, because I'm not going to live that way. 2 weeks later, I saw him over at his mother's house, and I called him over, and I said, Freddie, did you tell her? And he got very serious, and he said, I think I did. I said, in all of these years that this has been the prime object of your life, and now you only think you did, what happened? He said, we went to Vegas, we went to the Sahara Hotel, and we had the finest dinner I have ever had in my life sitting across the table from the woman that I love more than life itself. And we went into a show that is the greatest thing I will ever see in my lifetime. And he said there could not have been a greater bit of happiness in this world than what I felt there with this woman I love so much. And it got time to go upstairs to the room and we got in the elevator and I said to myself, I've got to tell her. And I didn't know how. And he said we got into the room and I knew I had to tell her and I didn't know what to say. And he said we started to get undressed. I got down to my pants, took them off, and it came to me. I threw them over to her, and I said, here, honey, put these on. And he said, she held them up and looked at them, and she says, well, you know I can't wear those. And he said, and don't you ever forget it. He said, she didn't say a word. Didn't say a word. She just continued to get undressed. She got down to her little bikini underpants. She threw them over to me, and she said, here, you get these in on. He said, I held up those little things, and I looked at her, and I said, well, you know I can't get into those. And she said, if you don't alter your attitude, you're not going to either. So with the seriousness that we all have with this program, with the newcomers who come here and feel that life is over, that pleasures are no longer going to be a part of our life, we come here and by simple actions of ourselves with the help of those about us, we are able to look at ourselves in our true light. We are able to understand that those things that we did were done under the pressure of alcohol, that we no longer need to do this, that we can at any given moment make the decision to drink or not to drink, that if we will adhere to these principles and live a life that we can do that which the book suggests that we do, the bottom line is to give service to yourself, to God, and to your fellow man. And I would like to close with a little story that Bill Wilson told many years ago. And I don't know whether it's true or not, but it has always affected me. A man who, before Bill told this story, was at a meeting, and he said, and he always did when he said, there are no good or bad people in the world. There are only those who know and those who don't. And our purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous is to teach those who don't know to know. That's what we're here for. And it's done through the power and the words that God puts into our hearts and into our lips. And Bill prefaced that by saying afterwards at a little luncheon, when he said, you know, a strange thing happened when Bob and I went to our first AA meeting when we'd gotten away from the Williams house. And we were going to attend our very first AA meeting together. He said, on the way over, we got to discussing what was going to happen and the whole picture of as we understood AA at that early days. And he said, one of the other of us said to the other one, you know, this might be a good opportunity to ask God to join us at this meeting. And he said, we decided to do that. So Bob and I asked God if he would please join us at this AA meeting. And he said, we went to the meeting with God in attendance. And he says, a strange thing occurred. God liked it so well that he's never missed a meeting since. Thank you very much.